copies of, but these are the questions that go with pages 97 to 192. If anyone doesn't have those, you're welcome to copy. We have a reference to the prophets endowed with constancy. Did we touch on that last week? Prophets endowed with constancy. Pages 212 to 221, inclusive, are related to the rejection based on belief in the finality of revelation, the rejection of the new manifestation because of beliefs in the scriptures of the previous people that made them to suppose that there would never be another prophet or manifestation after them, after their prophet, or but they felt that it would only be the return of their particular manifestation, as in the case of Christ, where the Christians believe actually Christ will come back again. So Baha'u'llah discusses some of that. On page 213 he refers to the spiritual disease involved in this. Even as the Christian divines who, holding fast to the verse of a gospel to which we have already referred, have sought to explain that the law of the gospel shall at no time be annulled, and that no independent prophet shall again be made manifest, unless he confirmeth the law of the gospel. Most of the people have become afflicted with the same spiritual disease, Baha'u'llah calls it. Page 214 deals with the theme of explanation of the verse, him whom God causeth to err through a knowledge. Although the outward meaning of this is the paragraph break on page 214, although the outward meaning of whom God causeth to err through a knowledge is what hath been revealed, yet to us it signifieth those divines of the age who have turned away from the beauty of God and who, clinging unto their own learning, as fashioned by their own fancies and desires, have denounced God's divine message and revelation. Say it is a weighty message from which ye turn aside. Likewise he saith, and when our clear verses are recited to them, they say, this is merely a man who would fain pervert you from your father's worship. And they say, this is none other than a forged falsehood. Give ear unto God's holy voice, and heed thou his sweet and immortal melody. Behold how he hath solemnly warned them that have repudiated the verses of God, and hath disowned them that have denied his holy words. Consider how far the people have strayed from the kosar of the divine presence, and how grievous hath been the faithlessness and arrogance of the spiritually destitute in the face of that sanctified beauty. Although that essence of loving kindness and bounty caused those evanescent beings to step into the realm of immortality and guided those destitute souls to the sacred river of wealth, yet some denounced him as a calumniator of God, the Lord of all creatures. Others accused him of being the one that withholdeth the people from the path of faith and true belief. And still others declared him to be a lunatic and the like. In like manner thou observest in this day with what vile imputations they have assailed that gem of immortality, and what unspeakable transgressions they have heaped upon him who is the source of purity. Imagine the position of the manifestation of God, knowing who he is, and seeing the response of the people, and knowing how much tragedy is involved in this. What abasement that those that should be welcoming the revelation are denouncing it and guiding the people away from it. And of course this was the role of the divines particularly. We see references to Baha'u'llah as having suffered as no one had ever suffered. And sometimes non-Baha'is, sometimes when we're starting reading the writings, we say, well, but he wasn't killed, and you know, he was in prison, and he was this and that of it. Some people have suffered more. I mean, physically, you know, they seem to have suffered more. So that would tell us that instead of trying to twist our logic around to say, well, he has suffered more, even though we don't know how, that there must be another dimension to this suffering. Do you suffer more from physical pain or from emotional anguish when you suffer? Now imagine the tragedy of Baha'u'llah. You talk of Christ as the man of sorrows. Baha'u'llah is the man of calamities. When you think of the possibility of the human race that was involved in Baha'u'llah's coming and in his presence on this earth, what greater sadness could there be on his part than the rejection of such a gift? And the only one really capable of understanding the dimension of the tragedy surrounding him was his own self. Fortunately, he gives us these passages. He reveals something of that in his prayers, his meditations, and in these excerpts that we have collected by Shoghi Effendi. God Passes By and The Promised Days Come. There's a few places where he's collected the sense of these. And it's very interesting in reference to this holy year to meditate on the sufferings of Baha'u'llah, to try to understand what in some way we can grasp from his words as to the dimensions of the agony and tragedy of his ministry. Whereas the world should have embraced him with love and rejoicing and sacrifice. On the contrary, they exiled him and closed him up in a prison and cursed him and called him a lunatic. On page 216, again, we have this reference to the prophets endowed with constancy, whose loftiness and glory shine as the sun, were each honored with a book which all have seen, and the verses of which have been duly ascertained. Now, this is this term, the prophets endowed with constancy, is exactly as it states here, signifies a messenger of God who has come with a book, an independent system, if you will, of laws. The lesser prophets, the secondary manifestations of God, are dependent on the laws of one of the great prophets endowed with constancy. For instance, the Israelite prophets that came after Abraham and Moses didn't introduce a new legal code. They prophesied, they elaborated the book, but they came under the shadow of that book, under the Torah. On page 220, Baha'u'llah again refers to this category of manifestations. At the bottom of the page, he says, "Hast thou not heard that among the reasons why certain prophets have been designated as prophets endowed with constancy was the revelation of a book unto them? And yet how could this people be justified in rejecting the revealer and author of so many volumes of verses and follow the sayings of him who hath foolishly sown the seeds of doubt in the hearts of men, and who Satan-like hath risen to lead the people into the paths of perdition and error?" The paragraph break on page 221 constitutes the beginning of the last series of extracts that Shoghi Effendi chose out of the Kitab-e-Ghan to include in his selection of the writings of Baha'u'llah in the Gleanings. And this is really the section of the book which deals with demonstrating the truth of the Bab's revelation. Is one of the central themes, if you will, of the Kitab-e-Ghan. In fact, the whole book aims at that, but it comes at it through different ways, by setting the stage for how one's to understand spiritual prophecies and some of the symbolic meaning of the terms found in the holy books of the past, steps and stages through which Baha'u'llah draws the student and the reader so that he can make his way through the misunderstandings which have existed. Having done that, he now moves on to the very character and nature of the Bab and some of the prophecies directly related to him. The last section that we discussed had to do with centering oneself on the verses of the Quran in the case of the Muslims, in the case of the uncle of the Bab to whom the book was originally addressed, who had expressed concern about some of the prophecies not having been fulfilled by the Bab literally. And he says that what we should hold to are not the sayings of Muhammad and the sayings of the Imams, but we should hold to the verses of the book. And then he demonstrates from the book how treacherous this question of rejecting a messenger of God when he comes can be, and how the same things that are being said in this day about the Bab were previously said already by the enemies of Muhammad and have been cited in the Quran, of which we've just read some examples. So the sections that he quotes here begin with this, amongst the proofs demonstrating the truth of this revelation. I'll read some of that for us. Do you have that in the English edition as well? You know where you are? Amongst the proofs demonstrating the truth of this revelation, remember this is the Babi revelation he's referring to here, is this, that in every age and dispensation, whenever the invisible essence was revealed in the person of his manifestation, certain souls, obscure and detached from all worldly entanglements, would seek illumination from the sun of prophethood and the moon of divine guidance, and would attain under the divine presence. Now, again, having spoken on this theme earlier, attainment under the divine presence, we know that that's attainment unto the presence of the manifestation with the acuity and spiritual receptivity to recognize it. Was there people that attained his presence but didn't attain under the divine presence? So this is the question of those that recognized in the messenger of God, in this case in the Bab, the mouthpiece, if you will, of God, the reflection of his glorious presence in this world. For this reason, the divines of the age and those possessed of wealth would scorn and scoff at these people, even as he hath revealed concerning them that erred. Then said the chiefs of his people who believed not, we see in thee but a man like ourselves, and we see not anyone, any who have followed thee, except our meanest ones of hasty judgment. Nor see we any excellence in you above ourselves. Nay, we deem you liars. They cavilled at those holy manifestations and protested, saying, none has followed you except the abject amongst us, those who are worthy of no attention. Their aim was to show that no one amongst the learned, the wealthy, and the renowned believed in them. By this and similar proofs, they sought to demonstrate the falsity of him that seeketh not but the truth. In this mighty resplendent, in this most resplendent dispensation, however, this most mighty sovereignty, a number of illumined divines, of men of consummate learning, of doctors of mature wisdom, have attained unto his court, drunk the cup of his divine presence, and been invested with the honor of his most excellent favor. They have renounced for the sake of the beloved the world and all that is therein. Now, Shoghi Effendi, when he extracts this, now skips down to the bottom of the next page. We'll come back to this section that we're going to skip. We'll go on to hear the passage the way it's read in the gleanings, the way it's seen in the gleanings. All these, he's still referring to these divines and illumined men of learning, all these were guided by the light of that sun of divine revelation, confessed and acknowledged his truth. Such was their faith that most of them renounced their substance and kindred and cleaved to the good pleasure of the All-Glorious. They laid down their lives for their well-beloved and surrendered their all in his path. Their breasts were made targets for the darts of the enemy, and their heads adorned the spears of the infidel. No land remained which did not drink of the blood of these embodiments of detachment, and no sword did not bruise their necks. Their deeds alone testify to the truth of their words. Doth not the testimony of these holy souls, who have so gloriously risen to offer up their lives for their beloved, that the whole world marveled at the manner of their sacrifice, suffice the people of this day? Is it not sufficient witness against the faithlessness of those who for a trifle betrayed their faith, who bartered away immortality for that which perisheth, who gave up the kosar of the divine presence for salty springs, and whose one aim in life is to usurp the property of others? even as thou dost witness how all of them have busied themselves with the vanities of the world and have strayed far from him who is the Lord of the Most High, the Lord, the Most High. Be fair, he goes on, he says, is the testimony of those acceptable and worthy of attention, whose deeds agree with their words, whose outward behavior conforms with their inner life. The mind is bewildered at their deeds, the soul marvelous at their fortitude and bodily endurance. Or is the testimony of these faithless souls, who breathe not but the breath of selfish desire, and who lie imprisoned in the cage of their idle fancies, acceptable? Like the bats of darkness, they lift not their heads from their couch, except to pursue the transient things of the world, and find no rest by night, except as they labor to advance the aims of their sordid life. Immersed in their selfish schemes, they are oblivious of the divine decree. In the daytime, they strive with all their soul after worldly benefits, and in the night season, their sole occupation is to gratify their carnal desires. By what law or standard could men be justified in cleaving to the denials of such petty-minded souls, and in ignoring the faith of them that have renounced, for the sake of the good pleasure of God, their life and substance, their fame and renown, their reputation and honor? Moves on, and he then extracts from page 226, around the middle of the page, with what love, what devotion, what exaltation and holy rapture they sacrifice their lives in the path of the All-Glorious. To the truth of this, all witness. And yet how can they belittle this revelation? Hath any age witnessed such momentous happenings? If these companions be not the true strivers after God, who else could be called by this name? Have these companions been seekers after power or glory? Have they ever yearned for riches? Have they cherished any desire except the good pleasure of God? If these companions, with all their marvelous testimonies and wondrous works, be false, who then is worthy to claim for himself the truth? I swear by God, their very deeds are a sufficient testimony and an irrefutable proof unto all the peoples of the earth, were men to ponder in their hearts the mysteries of divine revelation. And then he quotes the Quran, and they who act unjustly shall soon know what lot awaiteth them. And finally, he ends this section with about the middle of the page. He says, consider these martyrs of unquestionable sincerity, to whose truthfulness testify the explicit text of the book, and all of whom, as thou hast witnessed, have sacrificed their life, their substance, their wives, their children, their all, and ascended unto the loftiest chambers of paradise. Is it fair to reject the testimony of these detached and exalted beings to the truth of this preeminent and glorious revelation, and to regard as acceptable the denunciations which have been uttered against this resplendent light by this faithless people, who for gold have forsaken their faith, and who for the sake of leadership have repudiated him who is the first leader of all mankind? This, although their character is now revealed unto all people who have recognized them as those who will in no wise relinquish one jot or one tittle of their temporal authority for the sake of God's holy faith, how much less their life, their substance, and the like. Back on page 222-223, we have a list of some of these unique souls, illumined divines, doctors of mature wisdom. And Baha'u'llah says, we will mention the names of some of them, that perchance it may strengthen the faint-hearted and encourage the timorous. Among them was Mullah Hossein, who became the recipient of the effulgent glory of the Sun of Divine Revelation. Then Baha'u'llah makes this amazing statement. He says, but for him God would not have been established upon the seat of his mercy, nor ascended the throne of eternal glory. Shoghi Effendi, when he characterizes Mullah Hossein in God Passes By, he quotes this verse from the Begone. Mysterious, doesn't explain it, he just quotes it. In one of his tablets, you know, revealed after the Akdas, Baha'u'llah speaks about how the spirit, or those qualities of the spirit present in the previous manifestations, have returned in this day. And he identifies Mullah Hussein with the return of Muhammad, the Prophet of God. He is the Babul Bab, the gate of the gate. And yet he assigns unto him this similarity in spirit and character of Muhammad. So Muhammad, through Mullah Hussein, has become the first, if you will, to recognize the Bab. Well, first we could say that the dust of the manifestations is the same dust as everybody, but it's the other, that other difference. It's by reflection, I suppose. I would say by the purity, that would mean I'm my own, and I'm wandering into the area of my own understanding here, but let's say by the purity of his nature, he was able to reflect these things. Just like Abdu'l-Bahá is such a clear mirror of Baha'u'llah's beauty and intensity. It's mysterious. We don't know. That's one of the things. How is Baha'u'llah, who is the most great manifestation of God, the return of the third Imam? This is a mystery, Shoghi Effendi says. This is a mystery. Mysteries are not understood, he said. This is something here. That's why it's a mystery. If you could understand it, it wouldn't be a mystery anymore. So he says, this is a mystery. The station of Abdu'l-Bahá is a mystery. How can you have a human being that has all the qualities of the manifestation of God and his omniscience and still be a human being? This is a mystery. Indeed, he is a human being, but he partakes of those superhuman qualities of the manifestation. That's a special kind of mystery. He said the virgin birth of Jesus, the conception and virgin birth of Jesus, this is a mystery. That's a mystery of Christianity. It remains a mystery for us too, but it's still a mystery. This is a faith that has mysteries. Science and religion go hand in hand, but it doesn't mean that there aren't any mysteries. There are still some mysteries. And when people say, but that's not logical and that's not reasonable, and I don't know what, you remember the letters we read from Shoghi Effendi where he said about the virgin birth, for example, he said that God is able to transcend his creation. He is above his creation. He made his creation. He can reorder it and he can interrupt it when he wishes. We don't know how or why, but we shouldn't imagine or try to place limits on what God is capable of doing. Part of the sign of his he doeth whatsoever he willeth is he interrupteth the very clear patterns of things at times, causes something different to happen, and then returns. Patterns keep going on, but there are these unique moments, if you will, or unique situations that arise. Among them also was Sayyid Yahya, that unique and peerless figure of his age. A little more about Mullah Hussein. We'll quote some of these other titles, and then we'll go on to Sayyid Yahya. Sayyid Yahya, you know him more by the name of Vahid. Mullah Hussein, the first letter of the living, surnamed the Babul Bab, designated as the primal mirror, on whom eulogies, prayers, and visiting tablets to a number equivalent to thrice the volume of the Quran had been lavished by the pen of the Bab. You know how long the Quran is? Three times that length. The Bab's writings eulogize and compose. He's composed prayers and tablets of visitation for Mullah Hussain. Referred to in these eulogies as the beloved of my heart, the dust of whose grave that same pen had declared was so potent as to cheer the sorrowful and heal the sick, whom the creatures raised in the beginning and in the end of the Babi dispensation envy and will continue to envy till the day of judgment, to whom Sayyid Qazim had paid such tribute that his disciples suspected that the recipient of such praise might well be the promised one himself. You remember that Mala Hussain was a disciple of Sayyid Qasim. You can see God Passes by, page 50, for more, and also there's numerous references, of course, to Mullah Hussain in the Dawnbreakers. Mullah Hussain is buried in the shrine of Sheikh Tabarsi, which was the center of the fortress of Sheikh Tabarsi. Sheikh Tabarsi was a well-known sheikh, and his resting place is the shrine. And most of the shrines of Islam are places where one can take refuge when being attacked by your enemy. And the Babis went there and gathered there, but they were continually attacked, and in which case, now then they built a fortress wall, a barricade around, out away from this building, this the shrine of Sheikh Tabarsi is very humble. It's about, constitutes a area of space about the size where you're sitting, where these chairs are. It's no bigger than that. It has two rooms, and in the back room is a ornate wooden carved grill that leaves a passage about this way, this wide, all the way around it, and it constitutes the center of the of that room. And within that is the tomb of Sheikh Tabarsi himself. Now the Babis, Quddus there with Mullah Hussain, occupied the front room and would visit and pray there as well. And from there they went in and out, came out of the fortress with the, in the various battles they were engaged in, until Mullah Hussain was killed. Mullah Hussain was buried in the back room. If this was the front door, if you're looking at this from the top of the building, there's these two rooms. There's the front door here. Then there's a door here that leads into this passage that goes around the shrine. In this corner, under the floor, the rocks that constitute the flooring there, the body of Mullah Hussain was buried. When we were in Persia, I was able to... We were just lucky. One day we were able to get through. We went at siesta time in May, in the middle of the day, and it was warm, and there was nobody around. And a number of people who've gone there have never gotten there. Because people come out of their farms and things and bang on the car, and you have to go back again. This happened with Bill Sears, and it happened with Mr. Olinga. They got close, but they couldn't get there. But this day, somehow, we were all lucky, and we got in. It was with Hadi Rahmani and some of the friends that took us there. And we were able to go right to this site, visit it, and go to this place and prostrate here where the remains of Mullah Hussain are, and where you remember these marvelous words about the dust and the influence of the dust, and collect a little dust. There was plenty of dust there. And one old lady who was around there sweeping around outside ran off, so we didn't stay very long. We were able to circle the shrine and take a few photographs. And the potency of that spot, I mean, the whole place is covered with martyrs' graves. You don't know where they are. They're all under the soil all around there. Such a place that friends will be able to visit again in the future, I hope. It's just charges you with all those feelings and wonders of the Dawnbreakers. And you see again the scenes of Quddus with Mullah Hussain and the kind of spiritual love that bonded all these souls together as they gave up their lives for the Bab, for the beloved. And another one of these great souls was Sayyid Yahya. Sayyid Yahya Darabi, surnamed Wahid, to be distinguished from Wahid, and that's why it's important to learn the vowel sounds of the Persian pronunciation, because otherwise you're saying something else. If you say Wahid, the great hero of the faith, Wahid, nobody's going to understand what you're saying, except maybe somebody else who pronounces it the way you do. So if we can get the pronunciation straight and realize that Vahid and Vahid are two different words, and they're only different because of those little markings on the A and the I. And to distinguish between the short and the long vowels takes a little bit of concentration. If you've done it, you've got it. Then you're able to pronounce it closer to what it is in the original. We Westerners never seem to pronounce it right, but a little more. It gives the Persians a better chance to guess what you're saying than if you have the vowels all fouled up. It's worth an effort to try to do that. He was a distinguished Muslim divine himself, who after three successive interviews with the Bab recognized him and arose to champion his cause. You remember the story of him having been sent by the Shah, appointed to go and interview the Bab and find out about this thing. And he was so overwhelmed and impressed that he didn't bother to go back and make a report. He just wrote back and stayed in the service of the Bab. He was eventually he arose to champion his cause. He was eventually martyred at Nehriz on June 29, 1850, just 10 days before the execution of the Bab himself. The commotion in Shiraz after the return of the Bab from his pilgrimage had assumed such proportions, and then this is a reference to look up in the Dawnbreakers about Sayyid Yahya from page 173 on, starting with the commotion. God Passes By, also pages 11 and 12. There's a resume of the siege of Nehriz and the suffering and heroism of Vahid. Also pages 42 to 44 and page 50 of God Passes By, further reference. Now, of course, in the original text, these names were not smaller, but in the English edition they've been reduced to a list. They just go on continuing in the lines. So we have Mullah Muhammad Ali Zanjani. And what I could find out about this gentleman is he's another famous advocate of the cause of the Bab. You can see a reference to him on page 12 of God Passes By. A few other additional ones. He was martyred together with 1,800 fellow disciples in the upheaval at Zanjan in 1850. See Dawnbreakers chapter 24. The next one is Mullah Ali Bastami, characterized in God Passes By as energetic and audacious. Mullah, again, he was a clergyman. One of the letters of the living. The first to leave the house of God, which is the title that the Bab had given to Shiraz, to leave the house of God and the first to suffer for his sake. He was excommunicated, chained, disgraced, imprisoned, and in all probability done to death. It's interesting, Shoghi Effendi leaves this doubt about his end. There's now more facts that have come to light. He was sent to Baghdad. He was tried there. He was sent on, evidently, to Constantinople and was in slave labor there until he died. There's some articles in the World Order magazine, other places, that have since done, they were able finally to trace. Mullah Saide Barfirushi. Barfirushi, I think it's this second, the middle I in that should be unaccented. If it is in your book, maybe it's been corrected. My edition still has an accent on it. It's supposed to be removed. Barfirushi rather than Barfirushi. According to Nabil's narrative, he was one of those who fought at Sheikh Tabarsi. Mullah Yusufi Ardabili is one of the 18 letters of the living. You can find references to him in the Dawnbreakers. Mullah Mehdi Khoi was one of the 18 letters of the living as well. He was martyred at Sheikh Tabarsi. Sayyid Hosseini Torshizi was one of the seven martyrs of Tehran. He was a former mujtahid, high-ranking clergyman. See Dawnbreakers, page 455, 56. Am I going too fast? I don't know whether you're taking notes on these. It's hard to get all this information. If you could get it down, if you want to have references to it, take it down. Mullah Mehdi Gandhi, he was martyred at Sheikh Tabarsi. Mullah Baqir, another of the letters of the living, he was from Tabriz. See Dawnbreakers 368 and 505. Mullah Abdul Khaliqi Yazdi, a Sheikhi divine and author of numerous works mentioned in Nabil's narrative. Mullah Ali Baraghani, a paternal uncle of Tahiri, a prominent Sheikhi divine renowned for his zealous devotion. And others, well nigh 400 in number, whose names are all inscribed upon the guarded tablet of God. And guarded tablet usually refers to the knowledge of God rather than obviously a material thing, something, a spiritual record of sorts. On the next page is the reference to the Qusar. We've already seen what that was above. You know, it's a, maybe some of you weren't here earlier in the course, we'll look back and see what the origins of that was. Literally means abundance. It's traditionally a river in paradise whence all other rivers derive their source. In the writings of Baha'u'llah, the term is often translated as a heavenly river or a living fountain and similar phrases. For example, in the long obligatory prayers, make my Lord, O my Lord, a fountain of living waters. That's the original, is there also Qusar. We have a reference here to just after the quotations that we were referring to. Behold how the divine touchstone hath, according to the explicit text of the book, separated and distinguished the true from the false. Notwithstanding they are still oblivious of this truth, and in the sleep of heedlessness are pursuing the vanities of the world and are occupied with thoughts of vain and earthly friendship, leadership. Then he quotes, O son of man, from the hidden words, O son of man, many a day hath passed over thee whilst thou hast busied thyself with thy fancies and idle imaginings. How long art thou to slumber on thy bed? Lift up thine head from slumber, for the sun hath risen to the zenith. Haply it may shine upon thee with the light of beauty. This is a very suggestive phrase, light of beauty. There's another passage where Baha'u'llah says, the revelations of thy matchless beauty have at all times been imprinted upon the realities of all things visible and invisible. You can find that in the Gleanings, page 63. Baha'u'llah declares, after having given the names of these divines and talked about the example of their sacrifice, their renunciation, let it be known, bottom of page 228, let it be known, however, that none of these doctors and divines to whom we have referred was invested with the rank and dignity of leadership. For well-known and influential leaders of religion who occupy the seats of authority and exercise the functions of leadership can in no wise bear allegiance to the revealer of truth, except whomsoever thy Lord willeth. But for a few, such things have never come to pass, and few of my servants are the thankful. Quotes from the Quran. Even as in this dispensation, not one amongst the renowned divines in the grasp of whose authority were held the reins of the people hath embraced the faith. Nay, they have striven against it with such animosity and determination that no ear hath heard and no eye hath seen the light. The Bab, the Lord, the Most Exalted, may the life of all be a sacrifice unto him, hath specifically revealed an epistle under the divines of every city, wherein he hath fully set forth the character of the denial and repudiation of each of them. Wherefore take ye good heed, ye who are men of insight. By his references to their opposition, he intended to invalidate the objections which the people of the Bayan might raise in the day of the manifestation of the Mustaghas, the day of the latter resurrection, claiming that whereas in the dispensation of the Bayan a number of divines have embraced the faith, in this latter revelation none of these have recognized his claim. His purpose was to warn the people lest, God forbid, they cling to such foolish thoughts and deprive themselves of the divine beauty. Yea, these divines to whom we have referred were mostly renowned, unrenowned, and by the grace of God they were all purged of earthly vanities and free from the trappings of leadership. Such is the bounty of God, to whom he will, he giveth it. I don't know if you have that reference. That last quotation there is from the Quran, 57:21. Surah 57, verse 21. Such is the bounty of God, to whom he will, he giveth it. The manifestation of the Mustaghas, we have a footnote there, it says, he who is invoked. The day of the latter resurrection is a reference to the coming of Baha'u'llah's own revelation. There are some interesting notes between God Passes By and the Dawnbreakers about the Mustaghas, the numerical value of which has been assigned by the Bab as the limit of the time fixed for the advent of the promised manifestation. Baha'u'llah. You know, in Arabic the letters have numerical equivalents that remain the same under the abjad system of numerical equivalents. So if you add the value of the M and the S and the T and the gain and the TH here, you come up with the number of years beyond which won't pass before the manifestation appears. Quote, it says here from the Dawnbreakers, or from God Passes By, during the Bab's confinement in the fortress of Cherik, the Lohe Hurufat was the tablet of the letters, was revealed in honor of Dayan. A tablet which, however misconstrued at first as an exposition of the science of divination, was later recognized to have unraveled on the one hand the mystery of the Mustaghas, and to have abstrusely alluded on the other to the 19 years which must needs elapse between the declaration of the Bab and that of Baha'u'llah. 1844-1863. You'll find that in God Passes By on page 27. You should see the Dawnbreakers also, pages 304-305, where Nabil writes concerning Baha'u'llah's explanation of the mystery of the Mustaghas, which was revealed in answer to a request made of him while he was in Akka. Nabil says, Baha'u'llah adduced from the statements of the Bab irrefutable evidence proving that the appearance of the man Yazir-Ruhullah, he whom God will make manifest, must needs occur no less than 19 years after the declaration of the Bab. The mystery of the Mustaghas had long baffled the most searching minds among the people of the Bayan, and it proved an unsurmountable obstacle to their recognition of the Promised One. The Bab had himself in that tablet unraveled that mystery. No one, however, was able to understand the explanation which he had given. It was left to Baha'u'llah to unveil it to the eyes of all men. That's a quote from the Dawnbreakers. God Passes By was 27, the Dawnbreakers 304-305. Passing now to page 230, he says, another proof and evidence of the truth of this revelation, which amongst all other proofs shineth as the sun is the constancy of the eternal beauty in proclaiming the faith of God. Though young and tender of age, and though the cause he revealed was contrary to the desire of all the people of the earth, both high and low, rich and poor, exalted and abased, king and subject, yet he arose and steadfastly proclaimed it. All have known and heard this. He was afraid of no one. He was regardless of consequences. Could such a thing be made manifest except through the power of a divine revelation and the potency of God's invincible will? By the righteousness of God, were anyone to entertain so great a revelation in his heart, the thought of such a declaration would alone confound him. Were the hearts of all men to be crowded into his heart, he would still hesitate to venture upon so awful an enterprise. He could achieve it only by the permission of God, only if the channel of his heart were to be linked with the source of divine grace, and his soul be assured of the unfailing sustenance. Riches. Gracious God, in his book which he hath entitled the Qayyumu Asma, the first, the greatest, and mightiest of all books, he prophesied his own martyrdom. In it is this passage: O thou remnant of God, I have sacrificed myself wholly for thee. I have accepted curses for thy sake, and have yearned for naught but martyrdom in the path of thy love. Sufficient witness unto me is God, the exalted, the protector, the Ancient of Days. And of course, in this passage, Remnant of God is a title of Baha'u'llah. The Qayyum al-Asma, as you know, is the Bab's commentary on the Surah of Joseph. It was the first of his works. And the opening chapter of it was revealed for Mullah Hussein on the night of the declaration of the Bab. Shoghi Effendi states that its fundamental purpose was to forecast what the true Joseph, in other words Baha'u'llah, would in a succeeding dispensation endure at the hands of one who was at once his arch-enemy and blood brother, in reference to Mirza Yahya. The work comprises about 9,300 verses and is divided into 111 chapters, each chapter a commentary on one verse of the above-mentioned surah, the surah of Joseph in the Quran. Prophesied his own martyrdom, as you know, of course, the Bab was publicly martyred in Tabriz in 1850. He was at the time 31 years of age. And his ministry had entered its seventh year. In the book, the Kitab-i-Panshan, one of his last works, the Bab had alluded to the fact that the sixth Nowruz after the declaration of his mission would be the last he was destined to celebrate on earth. So he actually gave the year of his martyrdom as well. The reference to that is God Passes By, page 51. This title, The Remnant of God, the Arabic is Baghiyatullah. It's a title applied both to the Bab and Baha'u'llah. Here it's an allusion to Baha'u'llah. This quotation is from chapter 58 of the Qayyum al-Asma. For the context, you can see it with the rest of the verses that are around it on page 59 of Selections from the Writings of the Bab. Likewise, in his interpretation of the letter Ha, he craved martyrdom, saying, Methinks I heard a voice calling in my inmost being, Do thou sacrifice the thing which thou lovest most in the path of God, even as Hussein, peace be upon him, hath offered up his life for my sake. And so on. The letter Ha is a very exalted letter. Ha is the name of that age, this particular age. And this has meaning with reference to the Kitab-i Aqdas, because there you have the Ayam-i-Ha. The numerical equivalent of it is 5. The intercalary days are 4 or 5, as you know. And Baha'u'llah says that we have designated this Ha because these days are free from the constraints of the months and the years. Why would he associate Ha with those days which were free from the normal limitations of the calendar? And this comes back to the Bab's interpretation and also the writings of Abdu'l-Baha. He talks about this, where Ha is, among other things, a symbol of the divine essence. And this is the Ha-Hut. If you're familiar with the Persian terms, you've got the Nasut and the Malakut and the Jabarut and the Lahut and the Ha-Hut. It's the stages of the invisible realm, so to speak, different degrees. Translated roughly, the mortal realm and the kingdom and the dominion on high and the realm of divinity and the supreme identity, I could say, the Ha-Hut, the realm of the Hu, of the He of God. He is himself, the divine being. That exalted realm, he says, is symbolized by these 4 days, 5 days of the Ayam-i-Ha. We get on the idea that they're days of having fun, because we're looking for another Christmas in the West or something. I don't know what it is, but it's caused us to do that. But they are not that. They are not days of laughter in that sense. It's a very sacred period in which Baha'u'llah says that you should feast yourself and others and give gifts, all of which are emulating the bounties that God gives to all of us all the time. In other words, because these days are associated with the essence of God, then we should also show these qualities. And he says, and read the tablets and celebrate God during these days. It's one of the things he talks about there. So there should be times of feasting and prayer and meditation in preparation for the fast. The letter Ha. We go back to the outline here, see if we can get it. Proofs related to the revelation of the Bab, pages 221 to 237. The first we dealt with was acceptance by a number of divines and men of learning, then the section about Mullah Hussein and Sayyid Yahya, the sacrifice of such men. There's a reference to the Imam Hussein on page 225. This was outside the quotes that we read at the bottom of page 225. Were not the happenings of the life of the Prince of Martyrs regarded as the greatest of all events, as the supreme evidence of his truth? This is a reference to the third Imam, the Imam Hussein. Did not the people of old declare that those happenings to be unprecedented? Did they not maintain that no manifestation of truth hath ever evinced such constancy, such conspicuous glory? And yet that episode of his life, commencing as it did in the morning, was brought to the close by the middle of the same day, whereas these holy lights have for 18 years heroically endured the showers of afflictions which from every side have rained upon them. The Imam Hussein's martyrdom all took place in one day, the attacks and the death of his family. And so then on page 227 he makes a reference to this. Furthermore, the sign of truth and falsehood is designated and appointed in the book. By this divinely appointed touchstone, the claims and pretensions of all men must needs be assayed, so that the truthful may be known and distinguished from the impostor. This touchstone is no other than this verse. Wish for death if ye are men of truth. We've already seen the reference to these tablets the Bab sent out to the divines of every city. The reference to the constancy and steadfastness of the Bab in proclaiming his faith, the prophecy of his own martyrdom. Pages 234 to 237 speak about the ascendancy of the Bab. And among 234, for example, and among the evidences of the truth of his manifestation were the ascendancy, the transcendent power and supremacy which he, the revealer of being and the manifestation of the adored, hath unaided and alone revealed throughout the world. No sooner had that eternal beauty revealed himself in Shiraz in the year 60, that would be 1260, short for 1260, and rent asunder the veil of concealment, then the signs of the ascendancy, the might, the sovereignty, and the power emanating from that essence of essences and sea of seas were manifest in every land. So much so that from every city there appeared the signs, the evidences, the tokens, the testimonies of that divine luminary. So forth. On the next page, reflect how in this world, who in this world is able to manifest such transcendent power, such pervading influence? All these stainless hearts and sanctified souls have, with absolute resignation, responded to the summons of his decree. Instead of complaining, they rendered thanks unto God, and amidst the darkness of their anguish, they revealed naught but radiant acquiescence to his will. It's evident how relentless was the hate, how bitter the malice and enmity entertained by all the peoples of the earth towards these companions. The persecution and pain they inflicted on these holy and spiritual beings were regarded by them as means unto salvation, prosperity, and everlasting success. Hath the world since the days of Adam witnessed such tumult, such violent commotion? Notwithstanding all the torture they suffered and manifold the afflictions they endured, they became the object of universal opprobrium and execration. Methinks patience was revealed only by virtue of their fortitude, and faithfulness itself was begotten only by their deeds. On page 237 is this remarkable reference that Baha'u'llah makes. He says, although we did not intend to make mention of the traditions of a bygone age, yet because of our love for thee, we will cite a few which are applicable to our argument. We do not feel their necessity, however, inasmuch as the things we have already mentioned suffice the world and all that is therein. In fact, all the scriptures and the mysteries thereof are condensed into this brief account. So much so that were a person to ponder it a while in his heart, he would discover from all that hath been said the mysteries of the words of God, and would apprehend the meaning of whatever hath been revealed by that ideal king. Such a statement Baha'u'llah makes about the Iqan itself. Then it's because of the people, he says. As the people differ in their understanding and station, we will accordingly make mention of a few traditions, that these may impart constancy to the wavering soul and tranquility to the troubled mind. Thereby will the testimony of God unto the peoples unto the people both high and low be complete and perfect. And then Baha'u'llah enters into a recitation of some of these major traditions. Let's go back to the notes for a minute here. Page 233, let's go back there. There's another note I have there. Steadfastness in the faith is a sure testimony and a glorious evidence of the truth. Even as the seal of the prophets hath said, two verses have made me old. Both these verses are indicative of constancy in the cause of God. Even as he saith, be thou steadfast as thou hast been bidden. Traditional saying of Muhammad, this is two verses have made me old, there's no source on it, it's a hadith itself. It's a saying of Muhammad. Okay? And it's said that this is with reference to two Quranic verses, and these are the verses. Be thou steadfast as thou hast been bidden. That is from Surah 11, verse 122. Be thou steadfast as thou hast been bidden. And the other one is, for this cause summon thou them, and be steadfast as thou hast been bidden. Surah 42, verse 15. And Muhammad the Seal of the Prophet said with regarding to these verses, two verses have made me old. This is God invoking him to be steadfast. The implication being that you're going to have to hold because the people don't follow and don't obey and don't do what they're supposed to. And then he quotes one of these here, first of these two. Actually, it says 113. I found the Quran that I looked it up in, it was 11, verse 112. But the versification of the Quran varies from edition to edition. So when you go to look for something, if it's not right where you see it here, this is probably the numbering of Rodwell. But some of the other editions you'll find they're numbered in a different way. And there's now a standard Egyptian versification of the Quran that's being used more and more as the standard. It's not always clear where to count a new verse. There's a lot of ands between sentences. This is the Arabic form. Now consider how this Sadra, the Rizwan of God, Sadra is a tree. Baha'u'llah himself says about, finally he surrendered his soul and winged his flight under the realms above. This is, of course, the let's read this whole paragraph, it's good. And now consider how this Sadr of the Rizwan of God hath in the prime of youth risen to proclaim the cause of God. Behold what steadfastness that beauty of God hath revealed. The whole world rose to hinder him, yet it utterly failed. The more severe the persecution they inflicted on that Sadr of blessedness, the more his fervor increased, and the brighter burned the flame of his love. All this is evident, and none disputeth its truth. Finally, he surrendered his soul and winged his flight under the realms above. Baha'u'llah, with reference to the death of the Bab, he says, the more he, the Bab, exhorted them, the fiercer grew their enmity, till at last they put him to death with shameful cruelty. The curse of God be upon the oppressors. From the Gleanings, page 146. You're up to this point in the material. Do you have any questions or comments? What we've covered in this section. Does anybody want to ask anything? I haven't given you a chance. It's talking straight through. So you're all asleep and you don't ask any questions I can't answer. Please. Yes. Nasut, Malakut, Jabarut, Lahut, and Hahut. Some of these you've seen in the Seven Valleys. There's one place where he talks about this series of realms. The kingdom, the Malakut and the Jabarut, usually translated kingdom and dominion by Shobhi Effendi. For instance, these you'll find in the Hidden Words. I think the sixth of the Arabic Hidden Words says, "This is that which we have ordained for thee, and our kingdom on high, and our exalted dominion." And at first blush, you might look at that, and you might say, "Well, that's the same. Must be the same thing, you know, kingdom on high, exalted dominion." But there are two distinct stages of the invisible world, and the dominion is the seventh and highest one, the Jabarut. And Abdu'l Bahá talks about these stages of the soul and the realms of the relationship of the soul that occupies or attains to those stages in different tablets as well. The highest of the invisible realms, okay, from what we understand. And there's some reference in the tablets that the manifestation, the soul of the manifestation, is a native of that highest realm. In other words, we would have to evolve over I don't know how or when or through the grace of God if we ever attain to it. But the manifestation, he dwells in there when he's on the earth. In other words, he includes that dimension of spiritual vision and understanding at the level of the individual soul. He sees the wondrous scenery and the beauties of that realm, and he describes the visions that he has there in his tablets at times in this world, what he's seen in that spiritual realm. But that's the realm of the individual soul of the manifestations of God, where they're distinct. Now the next stage up is the Lahut. This is a stage of the divinity that's the same single divinity that is reflected and shineth from each of these holy manifestations of God in that first realm of objective existence, outer existence, individualization, if you will, of this divine principle that's there behind all of them, that creates an instrument. As Baha'u'llah says in one of his tablets, he fashions a ring and he places it upon his finger. And you could think of the ring as the body and being, the individual reality of the manifestation of God, and that hand representing the divine will, the realm of command, is always the same. He puts different rings on, takes them off, changes them. He is the supreme jeweler. It's a fascinating tablet. It's called the Loh-e-Zuhur, the tablet of the manifestation, where he speaks about this. And he appears in all the worlds of God at the same time. And they see him and they hear from him, and in one realm he speaks one language, in another realm he speaks another language, and his message is distinct and adapted relative to the needs of each of the realms that he appears in. Mysterious being. We saw this principle that we have the Godhead, we have an essence of God exalted above everything. And everything really, He surrounds everything. And anything in relation to Him is nothing, because He is existence and is real being. And we are a consequence of that, but don't rob it of anything. It doesn't change. To have us, it doesn't change at all. And since we're relative, and we are limited in time and in individuality, in relation to that divine source and principle of everything, we're really a kind of, you know, a transient something, or a transient nothing, if you want to call it that, in relation to that something that is God. In our own world and in our own house, we appear to be important, but in the great scheme of things, we are not particularly. What is so important about us is that we exist by that power. We partake of that being. And something of His makes us what we are. We are a mirror at our best, reflecting that principle, that divine essence and being, as manifested in the universal world of command, the primal will. So that magic power of everything in its, not in its individualized form, but in its united potential, reflects in our souls. Now, the mirror has a reality, but only in relation to what it reflects. If it's faced to God, then it's filled with the image and likeness of God. And isn't this what we see in the hidden words and here in the Igon, so many places, that this is the greatness of the human soul. It is potentially a mirror. It is the image and likeness of God. It can become the face of God. It can reflect and refract, if you will, that power, that essence, that love, that knowledge that is the reality of the holy manifestation of God, penetrates our being and shines out in a very unique way, in a unique display, because of our own individual endowments, which are distinct and different, and stages or diverse expressions of the infinity of possibilities which is resident in the divinity itself, but not expressed. It's expressed in this realms of endless universes. Now they're talking about how they found out where the universe was and where it starts and so on. I don't think in the light of the teachings that they're going to be able to do that conclusively. The writings state that the universe is infinite in range, so you don't go out there and find the edge of it, for one thing. But also, it's infinite in age. So there's never a beginning. On the other hand, they're gathering evidence about the Big Bang and the theory of it. So maybe if that happens, we will find out. Eventually they will find out. In fact, they're just finding out. There are more and more universes that they didn't know about. That the Big Bang is a local Big Bang. It's not the ultimate Big Bang, you know. And that would fit more within a Baha'i scheme of things, as far as I can tell. Relative to us, it seems to be the everything of our universe, but if we could get a broader picture, because the manifestation of God gives it to us. This question of origin of the universe and origin of the species and modification of the species is a great challenge to figure out what it's all about, and we're not to the bottom of the mysteries yet, and the way it's treated now is not in conformity with the basic things that we have in the writings still.
Friends, next week we will finish our study of the Gaon within the context of this humble series. I started off saying we never finished the study of the Gaon. The proper name for this is an introduction to the study of the Gaon. If we've gotten some impetus out of it that makes us want to really study the Gaon now, it will be have been worth our while. Just the fact that you've gathered and you come and you're reading and you're looking at these things and thinking about them has made me read it all over again. I don't know if I would have gotten to it if I hadn't given the course. And that's part of our lives here. It's hard to find time to do these things. But it's the kind of a book that you want to keep going back to. I wouldn't want to say how often you should read it, but I should think at least once a year you'd want to go through the Gaon if you want to keep on top of the changes that are taking place within your own being and your services to the cause and the dimensions of the text that will open to you because of your growing, your own experience, the tests you've, the sufferings and sorrows you've had. All of that will broaden and expand your capacity to grasp the meaning of the verses of the Gaon. So you've got a lot ahead of you. We all have ahead of us every time we come back to this. And if you're here 3 or 4 years from now, maybe you'll help me with another course. If I'm here 3 or 4 years from now, I don't know. Any of us. Yeah.